Okay, for those of you that are upstairs, those of you who were with us last night know where we're at. If you weren't, we're in 1 Timothy chapter 3, and we are going over some of the qualifications, or we're ultimately hope to go over all of the qualifications for the office of elder. We talked last night as we were winding down, maybe the last third or half of our session, on the qualification being the husband of one wife. I didn't feel like we totally exhausted that, and you may still have some comments. I did have several good comments, but I had one particular question come to me after services, and I thought it was very thought out, timely, and maybe one that you or I have had. And the question was, if a man has been married for a multiplicity of years and his wife dies, he's been the husband of one wife, would he then be qualified to be an elder? And I thought that was a legitimate question, and so I'm going to give you my best thinking of it. My answer was no. And the reason I said no is that in 1 Timothy chapter 3, I believe when it says the elder should be the husband of one wife, it is talking in the present tense, not in the past tense. I told this person, I can certainly understand the logic of why this man would be qualified, because he'd had maybe decades of marital experience. He may know more about marriage than those of us that are married. But having said that, the tense form there, I believe, is the present tense. So I would not be comfortable doing that, even if the man was exceedingly qualified otherwise. And in the fifth chapter of 1 Timothy, when Paul is talking about the widows and taking the widows in, let me find the verse that I want. Verse 9, let not a widow be taken into the number under 60 years old, having been the wife. There Paul very, very clearly talks in the past tense. And so I think the distinct, obviously, if she's a widow, her husband has to be dead, so it has to be past tense. But I understand, or I view, or I would understand the qualification in 1 Timothy 3 for the elder to be in the present tense and not in the past tense. Even though that man might be a real wealth of good, wise judgment. And I told this person, that sounds to me like a person that even if they weren't, quote, qualified in the sense of 1 Timothy 3, sounds like somebody I'd like to be able to talk to and get some counsel from just because of their wisdom. So, but I thought that was a legitimate question. And again, like all of these things, you don't have to agree with me. But that's my best thinking. Does anybody have a comment on that or any other questions regarding the qualification of husband of one wife that you think it would be good for us to talk a little bit about? Coming to Tom.
To clarify, you're not saying that someone who had a wife and died while they were elders, that they should resign, are you? You're just saying that you would not install one. Or are you saying that?
No, your first phraseology was what I am saying.
Okay.
On the area, and maybe we didn't cover this, I don't know. I cover things in my mind. I don't always cover them with my mouth. And sometimes I'm better off when I don't cover them with my mouth. But to me, the Bible is silent on what to do when a man loses his wife and he's already in office. Okay. So in that silence, I take the position that I could not technically say that it is wrong. I think there's a judgment on the part of that man and on the part of the congregation. I've seen some congregations and some men where it would be better for that man to resign. I've seen other situations where the congregation wanted him to continue, and he was willing to continue, and I don't have a chapter verse to say that he can't continue. So I'm making that distinction, Tom, between the two things. And I know good brethren who feel like and have resigned when their wife died, and I respect them for that. But I don't bind that on them or a congregation in my own mind. Anybody else question or comment on any of this? Okay, we're all happy and we all completely understand it. So that's good. I'm going to be bow back in 1 Timothy 3, and I'm trying as best I can to take these in the order that Timothy gives them to us. Not that that order is any better than any other order. I think all of these are equal. But the next one that comes up is in the latter part of verse 2, after the husband of one wife, is that they are to be vigilant. The Revised Standard Version uses the concept of temperate. I think the King James uses vigilant. And the word that's used by Paul here to express that in the Greek is staphylion. And it's a word that carries in the Greek the idea of to be sober, to be circumspect, to be temperate, to be abstaining from excesses. And some of these qualifications are going to overlap because being temperate, for instance, in wine, he says, we're going to see later, not given too much wine. And if you look at 10 or 15 different English translations, they'll use slightly different words. I found vigilant, temperate, sober, reserved. I didn't really like reserved. I think vigilant and being circumspect and being watchful is the real thought that I get out of this. An elder should be someone who is watchful for danger, and we're going to see in other passages that one of the duties of an elder is to protect the flock from grievous wolves. Well, that takes someone that is a alert and watchful and not, shall we say, asleep at the switch. He's someone that is not dull of knowing what's going on within his flock. And obviously that simply makes sense to have a man that is circumspect. I like that word, circumspect. We don't use it too much anymore, but that has the idea of looking around and watching. Sometimes I'll get a call from an elder and they'll say, well, somebody visited us and we kind of like to use them. Do you know anything about them? Well, I'm not the clearinghouse, but I do appreciate an elder who just doesn't jump right into something without knowing who's going to be feeding his flock and how they're going to be feeding his flock. I think that's just a good eldersmanship, if that's a word. If it's not, it ought to be. Okay, the next one that we have here listed, and then I'll give you some time to comment on these as we go through them, but some of them are a little easier than others. He must be sober. And I take this to mean the concept of being sober-minded. It's from the Greek sophrona, and sophia is kind of the word for wisdom. This is someone who is sober-minded, discreet, prudent, moderate, and then there's some overlap between this and the concept that we just talked about to be vigilant. But there must be slight differences or they wouldn't be listed separately. To be sober-minded does not really, to me, carry the idea of someone that's not drunken. Obviously, someone that's drunk is not sober-minded. But Paul's going to cover that just a little bit later. But here we're talking about someone who I guess I would describe them as they know when to be serious. And I think humor and levity and enjoying one another in the proper context is a very important part of the Christian walk. But some people just don't know when to quit. And an elder needs to know when to be serious. He needs to, people need to know when he is serious, and they need to be able to depend upon him being serious. Next we have, he must be of good behavior. The Greek word that Paul uses here is kosmion, K-O-S-M-I-O-N, and it carries the idea of orderly, well-behaved, good behavior, unruffled, dignified in the behavior. It's a type of mind that is orderly and organized to the point that he can exercise his duties as an elder. Later, we're going to see one of the duties of an elder is to be able to convict or to convince the gainsayer. We're going to get that in Titus chapter 1. Well, someone that can't organize their thoughts and present them in a way that could call down a false teacher if that was necessary or correct a false teaching. Not all false teaching comes from false teachers, in my opinion. Those of you that have stood in the pulpit or taught a class, we've all said things that weren't correct. Sometimes I've said them because I didn't understand the passage. Sometimes I've said them just because my tongue and my brain weren't connected. And I appreciate when somebody pulls it out. But when we do that, I don't consider that... The teaching is false, but I don't consider that a false teacher, because the motive is not. And when someone corrects us in that regard, we thank them and we make a correction. And that's appropriate. But a false teacher is someone who's intentionally teaching that which is false and continually does it. And a good elder has to have a mind that's orderly, organized enough that he can handle that. Occasionally, that needs to be done in the assembly. Oftentimes, my opinion is, if it can be handled privately afterwards, that's probably often better. But if it's something that's just egregious, if somebody stands up here and says baptism is not necessary, I would hope the eldership would take issue with that and correct it. I'll go further than that. I hope you would take issue with that and correct it. You don't have to be an elder to do that. But sometimes it's just a misspoken word, or it's a younger person or someone newer in the faith. You can really damage them long term by calling them out in public if it's not necessary. So that's a judgment area. That is a judgment area. But I think one being orderly in their mind and able to organize their thoughts, that is a very important thing for an elder. And I put that somewhat in this category. I've covered two or three here now, and I'm not trying to see how fast I can go through these. I just don't want to be overly pedantic and plow this field, which I know you have plowed before. This congregation's gone through it recently. Vandalia's gone through it recently. And here I am again. So hopefully it's not overly redundant. I pause for a bit and let you say anything you'd like to say that's edifying. Okay, now that you've edified one another, we'll move on. In verse 2, the last one in verse 2 is apt to teach. And I guess I feel a little more compelled to make some comments on that even than the others. Not that it is less important. The Greek word here is stakatikon. And it's defined as apt to teach, apt and skillful in teaching. An elder has to be able to teach. And this is one, it's one of the few qualifications for an elder that we do not see for a deacon. I think it's good for deacons to be apt to teach, just because I think it's good for all Christians to be apt to teach. But it is a special one. It is given to the elders here, and we're not going to see it given to the deacons. The quality, I think, is somewhat relative. I mean, how good of a teacher do they have to be? Well, who's going to decide whether they're a good teacher? Some of you like certain people as teachers a little bit more than other people as teachers. That's usually a matter of style. I hope it's not a matter of content. So there is a relativism there also. In Titus chapter 1, verse 9, we're going to see that one of the qualifications that Paul gives Titus for elders is holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able or apt by sound doctrine both to exhort and to convince the gainsayer or the false teacher. That is an absolute requirement of an elder. It's an absolute requirement. Now, sometimes I have heard the argument, I don't buy it, but I'll share it with you, and you may share it. You may have heard it, you may believe it. Well, you can teach by example, and you don't have to be able to verbally teach. That is correct. But I think in order to convict the gainsayer, there has to be the ability to verbalize the doctrine rather than just doing it by example. So I would be hesitant. Well, I would be opposed if I was in the congregation to putting a man in who can only teach by example. Now, I wouldn't want to put a man in that can't teach by example, but I think the apt to teach has more than just an exemplary ability to let our light shine. It's also the ability to handle the Scripture. Study to show thyself approved, a workman unto God that needeth not to be ashamed. We all need to strive for that. An elder has to have that. Otherwise, things will creep in and they won't be refuted, And things that come in that aren't corrected eventually become in the minds of many the truth. And we can't, I don't believe that's what the Lord here has in mind at all. And the term shepherd or pastor, as we saw in 1 Corinthians 4, indicates one of the natures of the elder's work is to feed and teach the gospel. And he, as I said, he doesn't have to do all the feeding. He doesn't have to do all of the teaching, but he has to oversee it, and he has to be able to do it when it's necessary. And it is sometimes necessary. Sometimes because there's nobody else to do it, and sometimes because the congregation needs to hear from their elders and know what their elders believe and know that their elders are protecting them and are mentally and knowledgeable enough and skilled enough here to do it. So apt to teach is somewhat relative, but I don't think it's absolutely relative. I don't say you have to be a PhD college professor. I'm just saying you have to be able to explain the truth, and you have to know what the truth is so that you can present it in love, and, God forbid, when you have to do it, you can challenge somebody to the extent that it is needed. Comments or questions on apt to teach? Don't spread your mats, I'll call on you. Okay. Must not be, verse 3, not given to wine. We find this both here in 1 Timothy 3:3 and Titus 1:7. Somebody Sunday morning in my class, and those of you that weren't here, we were discussing marijuana, but somebody made the comment that anything that dulls our senses and causes us to not be able to divide the word mentally, it's not pleasing to God, whether it's heroin, whether it's crack cocaine, whatever it is. When it says not given to wine, I think the phrase given means not given to wine in excess. Now, this brings up the question, and I'll go back to the qualification, but I'll share with you my idea. Is it wrong for a Christian to ever consume any kind of wine? Well, you've probably heard the argument, well, wine back then wasn't fermented. Wine, and it wasn't always fermented, but it had to be fermented some of the time, or they wouldn't say, don't be drunken. You don't get drunk on grape juice. You may get sick on grape juice, but you don't get drunk on grape juice. There has to be some alcoholic content. And I think by far, the wisest course for a Christian is not to consume alcohol. Because if you don't consume it, number one, you're never going to get drunk. And there's an example issue there for people who maybe can't tolerate it as much as your system tolerates it. Having said that, I think this particular qualification is probably about being addicted to wine to the point of drunkenness. And we're all familiar with Paul telling Timothy, take a little wine for your stomach's sake. Well, that to me is obviously a medicinal use of it. Today, I think we've probably got better ways to get well than wine, but I'm not going to come unglued. But drunkenness, we know for sure, is inappropriate for a Christian. And this given to wine, I think when we get to the deacon, this says not given too much wine, which someone said, well, maybe the elder can drink more than the deacon. I don't think that's quite what that means. I think it means, it's not a way to go. And for me, the elder is to be, we're all to be Christians. An elder, in one sense, has to be almost an exemplary Christian because people are going to be watching. They watch you. And they watch us all. But for an elder to get involved in this would just be, open the floodgate for the flock. And I don't think that's where we want to go. But I suspect the real reasoning here is he has to be sober-minded and able to handle scriptures. And when your senses are dull, you're not. And that's not, to me, what an elder ought to do. John the Baptist, in his oath, did not drink wine or strong drink. Back in Leviticus chapter 10, verse 9, Aaron and his sons were forbidden from drinking wine or strong drink when they entered into the tabernacle. There seems to be an implication there when we're about the service of the Lord, And we need to be very, very careful about these things. I don't want to read into this passage what maybe Paul didn't say, but I don't want to minimize maybe what he did say. I will open it up if anyone wants to make a comment on that. We've got Randy over here.
I guess I would throw in the term maybe designated driver, because if you're an elder, you're the one piloting the flock, and you're the one that's setting the example. And I would suggest that if any of us have kids younger that we're steering our own family in the right direction, we might want to consider this as an advisement to everybody to watch what we're doing. If we're dulling our senses, we've got people watching us, and if we're supposed to be setting the example, then we should look at ourselves as designated drivers and kind of maybe look at that as a reason to steer clear, so we set a Christian example for those looking up to us.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Okay. Anybody else have anything you want to say on that? Okay, I'm going to drop down here, and I'll go back and pick up some of these that we haven't talked about, but I'm going to drop down with your, well, I'm going to do it without your permission, because I think there is interest in this, and we've got probably our largest assembly. I'm going to drop down to verse 5. Well, verse 4. An elder is to be one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? And when you look at Paul's instructions to Titus, he'll, at least in the King James, he uses the phrase that the elder should have faithful children. And the word for faithful used in Titus is pistis, which is the word for faith. Okay? So, along with the marriage issue that we find, husband of one wife, this one often comes up. So I'd like to spend some time on it tonight, maybe the rest of our time. That will depend upon you. There are really six Greek terms in this verse that I think are very important. I won't necessarily not bore you, burden you with the Greek words. You can go look them up. But the six words are own, when it says one that ruleth his own house. The second one that I would emphasize is house. The third one is ruling or governing. The fourth one is child. What does that mean? And then the fifth one would be subjection, and the sixth one would be believing or faithful. And what is this really saying to us? Well, let me just take a few minutes and share with you what my current conclusion is. I hope it doesn't change, but if it's not right, then I do hope it changes. Own means this is the family of the man. This is his family, and I would include in that the wife and his children, his own. House, I think here, is the concept. It's from the Greek word okio, and it means a house, a household, inmates of a house. Teenagers like that phrase, inmates of a house, because they feel like they're in prison sometimes. But it's his home, and I touched on this a little bit last night. We're talking here, I believe, about how a man rules his home, okay, and those that are under his roof, okay? Ruling has to do with the idea to govern or to control the will and the actions. Children, I think we understand what children here. It's a son or a daughter, a male or a female descendant. Obedience or subjection is the act or habit of obeying and compliance with the leadership of the man in his home. And believing, or here it says in the King James, He needs to rule his own house and take care of the church of God. There is an element here of obedience. Well, let me just tick off a few things that have come up in conversations I've had with people. Number one, and maybe this is sort of the easiest, is the idea of children. Some will look at this and say that an elder has to have a plurality of children, because children is a plural term. I think, however, when we go to the Bible and when we really look at that, the Bible often uses plural to include singular, and singular to include plural. And let me give you a few examples of that. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1, it says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." Now, if you're an only child, do you not have to obey your parents? I don't think any of us would take that position. Many times the Bible will use, and the word here is tekon, T-E-K-N-O-N. And we will use it sometimes in a plural sense or in a singular sense. But I don't understand this to mandate that the man have more than one child. He does have to have children. But it's the experience of raising a child. It's the experience of raising children. I do not believe this is in any way a biological phenomenon. I think if men adopt children and raise them, they've had the experience. The test here is not fertility. The test here is being able to Christian raise your family. Okay? And again, I do emphasize, at least for me, this has to do with their own home. But if a man cannot, and I don't mean this to be harsh, please, but if a man cannot lead his children to the Lord, it's a red flag. There's a reason for that. Now, once they leave our homes, God has given us all free will. And I view that somewhat differently. But in our homes, a man qualified for the eldership should be able to lead his children to the Lord. And if he can't, even if it's not his fault, and there's always some probably inference of that, but even if it's not a shortcoming on his, it certainly is not the example for people to instill confidence in that man. And I would be very, very hesitant to engage in that for both of those reasons. I don't want to be overly restrictive, but this passage, the two verses are on it, ruling your own house. And again, I include the wife. Remember, I had the question last night from somebody that said, if a wife is no longer conducting herself as a Christian, does that disqualify the man for being an elder? Well, there's some judgment in that, but that to me does not indicate ruling one's house well in a spiritual sense. And I'm not wagging my finger. I'm just trying to understand the scriptures in the best way that I can. I know seemingly very good people whose children do not come to the Lord, and they rebel even while they're under the roof. And I don't always understand that. I'll say I often don't understand that. But I don't think that is in harmony with this fourth and fifth verse. I think we need men and we need families who are able to bring their children to a belief in God and a belief in the Lord. And if we can't, if a couple can't do that, if a man can't do that, how is he going to do it for the flock? I hope that's not overly blunt, but it's my understanding of it, and I'll be happy to for you to comment on that. And again, you don't have to agree with me, but I'd like to hear your reasons why you don't. If you don't, it's a little bit of the third the third rail, I know. But it's an important rail. Max, were you? That was really your hand, wasn't it? Okay. Max has got a question.
I thought he was stretching.
He wasn't stretching this time. I had him frozen for a while. But he's got good thoughts.
So what if your family is in a situation where the children aren't old enough to leave the house, but they don't live with you, so they're not able to go to church with you as the husband? But they live with the mother or the wife.
Okay, we've got a split family.
Yeah, what if it's a divorce? Not really a divorce, but they live in two different places.
Well, so your question is, would that man be qualified to be an elder?
Yeah, since he
can't. I would say probably not, because you just described a split, dysfunctional family. And I don't mean that to be anything but kind. But that man's not ruling his house well, because he's not even living in his house or with his family. So I don't think that man, in my understanding, would be qualified. Doesn't mean he couldn't be a Christian under some circumstances. But I don't, I wouldn't be able to say yes to that.
Even if they're together still, or they are not able to go to the church.
Okay, you lost me just a tad there.
No, if they're still together. As
the husband and wife?
Yeah.
Together, you mean still married, mm-hmm. but not living together?
No.
No or yes? I mean.
Yes as in no, they're not.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. We're going to get there, Max. That's still not a man ruling his house well if he's not able to live with his, if the family's not together when they ought to be. So I would think that would be a real red flag, to the point of I would not recommend it. I don't think the scriptures allow it. I'll go that far.
So you're saying that a family should be together as much as possible in order to that?
Absolutely. And for an elder's family, it's not even preferable. It's I think, mandatory. Okay, Mike. Couldn't tell if it was you or Shauna. Maybe both of you.
In Titus's qualification, he says faithful children.
Yes.
There's a couple questions that I have. The first part of that question is I have heard an argument made that they are to be faithful to the Father,
yes,
rather than to God. And I believe what you've described was obedience to the gospel, which I would agree with. But could you comment on,
yes,
that position?
And I understand where it comes from. One of the thoughts from Titus, and you're absolutely right, it says faithful children, pistis, which I think I emphasize. I think my belief is when they're in his house, and he's ruling his house, they should be faithful to him and faithful to God. When they leave his home, the father's ability to keep them faithful to God, I think, is a little bit different. And it would be sad, and it might be a red flag as to why the man shouldn't be put in. But I don't hold the father to the same leadership spiritually to those who have left his home as I do to those who are still within his home, if that makes sense. Ideally, every elder's children would be Christians till they're 80. But there are some examples in the Old Testament, and I don't think this is an apples and oranges. I'll just give them for you to think of. Eli's sons were a disaster, and yet he was still the priest. Samuel's sons were a disaster, and yet he was still a prophet. You know, we often think, well, the children of Israel wanted a king because they wanted to be like other nations. That's true. But a secondary reason, they were afraid Samuel's kids would rise to power, and they didn't want that. Now, a high priest and a prophet are not the same as an elder. That's where my analogy breaks down. But there does seem to be work that happens once they leave the jurisdiction. But I do think Eli was chastised and maybe lost his life because he did not raise his children the way God would have wanted him to. So I think in Eli's case, and maybe Samuel's case, who probably learned how to be a father by watching Eli, because that's who he grew up with, There may have been things when those boys were home that the fathers didn't do, and God held them accountable for that. So,
the second part of that, my question is, if a man has a plurality of children, do all the children have to have obeyed before he's qualified? What I mean by that is if he has three children and a couple of them already obey, but one's still too young, could he still be qualified?
Yes, I'm making a distinction in my mind anyway, from my understanding, that even younger children have faith in the Lord, even if they're not to the age of accountability and have not come into the Lord. So let's say he's got a 18 and a 16-year-old and a 9-year-old. the 9-year-old may not have obeyed the gospel because he's just not ready. But you can tell if that 9-year-old has had a belief in God instilled in them. So if I understand your question, I would not object to that. Now, it does raise the question, how old should the children be? Well, the answer is 7.5. No, there is no answer. There is an answer, but there's not a numerical answer. I do believe it's just wise for the officer's children, whether it's an elder or deacon, his children are old enough that it's clear, fairly clear, that he's leading them in the right way. And a man who had 3 children, then they were 1, 2, and 3, I'm not sure you can tell at 1, 2, and 3 years old, spiritually, how that family's headed. So my judgment would be a little older than that. But God, in his wisdom, didn't put an age on it any more than he put an age on when should a child be baptized, because each child is a little different. My sister was baptized before I was. I'm 4 years old. I was 4 years older than my sister. She's now dead, but I was 4 years older than her. She was baptized 2 years before me. And I would have thought she'll be a Christian forever, and I probably won't. It turned out kind of to be the opposite. But we were just ready at different times. And that happens to you guys too. But there is a nervousness for parents when their kids get to be 16, 17, 18, and 19, and nothing's happened. You wonder, have I messed up? Well, just keep teaching them, but chill out a little bit. Because sometimes when you put a little pressure on them, they'll either do it for the wrong reason or they won't do it at all. So that's time for prayerful judgment, which is not part of this conversation. It just popped into my head. Does anybody else have a comment or questions on anything so far that we said regarding ruling one's house well? I think I could put in this not just simply the spirituality of it, of providing for one's family. It says if a man doesn't provide for his family, he's worse than an infidel. A man who does not provide for his family, unless he's incapacitated, to me is not ruling his house well. And I see more and more of that. I see more and more of that. I don't want to offend anybody, because I don't know if there's anybody here in this area but that has this. And I can't say it's absolutely wrong, but I get nervous about dads who are moms. I think it's good for a marriage for the man to support his family. I don't think it's wrong for a woman to work outside of the home, but I tell young ladies, don't marry a man that can't support you. If you want to work and still have your family as a priority so that you can make a down payment on a house or whatever, that's one thing. But God set it up for the man to lead the family. That's just, to me, that's a no-brainer. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, let me see if I had anything here I really wanted to say that I have. Oh, one of the reasons I believe that this has to do with children, even more so when they're under their own home. The word for children here, as I said, was technon. And it's not exclusively, but it often refers to what we would call younger children and not adult children. So I think that leads a little bit of credence to this. But if a man's adult children all apostatize, I don't believe that technically disqualifies him, but it certainly would be wise for the congregation or the evangelist, however you're doing it, to really look into that and make sure it's not a red flag that needs to be addressed. Okay. Somebody asked me, and they're not going to ask it out loud tonight, what if you just have a children that's loony? And that's a direct quote. And I don't mean that to be at all flippant. You know, if you have a child who's mentally or emotionally imbalanced, for want of a better phrase, that's a different issue. We've got a young lady in our home congregation. She's 35. She's Down syndrome. So she's really about a fifth grader. And I don't hold it against her parents that they haven't brought her to the Lord, because she's not quite able to grasp that. Every time I look at her, I'm just a tad envious, and this is going to sound crude, but if I understand Scripture correctly, she's going to go to heaven without having to go through what we're having to go through. I don't wish that on anybody, but I'll be honest. That's like go directly to go, collect your $200, and she's a real sweetie. She's a real sweetie. But that's a difference. My point is, that's different. That's not what I'm talking about. Going once or twice. Okay, I'm going to backtrack now and get back to verse 3. And we did not give unto wine. Not a striker. Has nothing to do with bowling or golf. It has to do with the way in which one conducts themselves. Titus 1:7 has this same sentiment. It comes from the Greek word plankton, and it carries the idea of someone who is not violent, not pugnacious, and not a fighter. This is not a quick-tempered person. This is not someone that, if I don't get my way, I'm bigger than you, and I'm going to swing my fist. I think that is largely what it means. I've heard it explained as someone that doesn't come upon somebody suddenly. Well, that could be, but you can come up behind someone and scare them, and it could be accidental. I don't think that's quite. This is just not a pugnacious. A man in the eldership has to be a peaceable disposition, if at all possible. Not striking out at others that oppose him. He needs to oppose those who oppose the truth, but not because they oppose him. He can't be ill-tempered. He can't be governed by his temper. In 1 Corinthians 13, in the King James, it talks about someone who is long-tempered, which I think is the antithesis of someone who is short-tempered. It's someone who tends to be patient, someone who tends to work in this way. The next one we have here in 1 Timothy 3 is not greedy for filthy lucre. And Peter addresses this also in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2. When he gives a few, I think, three additional or complementary requirements of an elder. And one of them is that they're not in it for the money. I think you understand filthy lucre is not being in it for the money. Now that raises the question, and it is not our normal practice to pay elders. And so sometimes I'm asked, would it be wrong or would it be right to pay an elder? I don't think it is wrong at all. And I would simply go over to the fifth chapter of Timothy and verse 17, where it says, let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor. And most students take double honor to be, they have the honor of being an elder, but they also, it would be appropriate to support them financially. Having said that, would I recommend it? Well, that's a case-by-case thing. The danger I see in that is that if you had three elders and you paid one of them, it could be very easy for the congregation or that elder or the elders to start look at the one that's paid full-time as being kind of elder one, and he's got more time, so we'll all go to him. And that would be inappropriate, because all elders are equal in authority. All elders are equal in responsibility. I have seen a couple of cases where elders were paid, and I thought that the congregations did it kind of neat. The one I'm thinking of is all three elders were retired. So they paid one elder 4 months, then they paid the next elder 4 months, they paid the last elder 4 months. So at the end of the year, they all paid them equal. I guess you could give each one of them the same amount each month if that would allow them to devote full time to the eldership without having to get a part-time job to supplement their Social Security or whatever. I don't think that would be wrong. That would erase the tendency to look at one as kind of above the others. That's my only real hesitancy. We tend not to do that, and it's probably not terribly necessary in our day and age with our social network, our social safety nets, our RMDs and various things. But if it would help a man or a congregation so that their elders could devote more time to it, I don't think it's unscriptural. I'll just leave it at that. I'm not advocating that you do it, but I don't think it is unscriptural. Any comments on that? Max, just a minute. You just want that box again.
Yeah, he wants to catch it.
So what you said about the kind attitude, what if you were being patient and watching what you're saying, you're handling your temper, but the opposition kept on questioning the faith,
mm-hmm,
and wouldn't let up and really was set on proving you wrong or proving you as untrustworthy for the congregation or able to lead, and they were just being a pest about it. Should you change your attitude? Is there something you can do?
I don't know that I'd say change your attitude, but you might change your action. I think at some point it can get to the point where you need to put that person out for the good of the congregation. You can still do that with love. They may not understand it to be love, but you can still do that with love. But if push comes to pull, in my book, the safety of the congregation comes first.
I mean, what I meant was when it's necessary to change the way you handle it. There's,
well,
a thin line, right?
I would change the way I handle it in that if you try and try and try and ask someone who's teaching falsely, for instance, to quit, and they won't, then at some point you have to change, and you just don't let them speak anymore, or put them out of the assembly. That really hardly ever happens, but should it happen, I think the spiritual safety of the congregation comes first. And if I'm not understanding your question, come to me afterwards. But I think that's what you asked.
Yeah. Okay.
Anybody else? I don't know if you've ever been in an assembly where the elders had to ask somebody to sit down or not. I have. Some of you may have. And sometimes it's been quite appropriate. The thing you have to watch is when you ask that person to sit down, everybody's going to remember it. Whereas if it's not so egregious and you don't have to do that, 70% of the people aren't even going to remember it. So you have to make that judgment. But if it's egregious or out of... I remember when I was about 7 years old, it happened in my home congregation in Indiana. I still remember it as if it was yesterday. And the man did sit down, but he was inappropriate in what he was chastising the elders because of an action the elders had taken. And he was absolutely wrong, and he was absolutely out of place, and I even knew that as an 8-year-old. But fortunately, that seldom happens. We're blessed. I think the harmony of our fellowship is a blessing in general. Okay, I'm going to have to ring the bell in a couple of minutes, so... Okay, I will go over one more, and this is the one in the third chapter of 1 Timothy, patient. Yeah, filthy lucre, but patient. Obviously, an elder has to be someone that's patient. It comes from the Greek word epikeia, and it means to be fair and reasonable and kind and at all possible mild. I think this is one of the real advantages to the multiplicity of elders. Some men just have a real gift to be patient. Other people are a little bit more, well, let's take the bull by the horns and get something fixed. And between them, maybe you get what's right. If we were all bull by the horns, it probably wouldn't work. And if we're all so patient that we never addressed issues, that probably wouldn't work. So I think that's one of the gifts here of patience. Obviously, I think that's one of the reasons that Paul says he needs to rule his house well. A man who has no patience is not going to rule his house well. His children are going to grow up hating him. And I've seen it. You've seen it. As soon as they can get out of there, they're gone. And it's sad. And oftentimes it seems to me like that's an issue of patience. Not that the father was wrong in what he said, but he was wrong in how he did it. You know, and we need to remember this in the church. It's often not what we say as much as how we say it. That's why Paul tells us to say the truth in love. You can say the absolute truth, but if we don't say it in love or with that attitude, it often is not going to have the right, the response that we want. Okay, we'll pause, or if anybody has anything to say before the kids come up, we will consider it. Tomorrow night, I'll finish out the qualifications of elder, and I'll look a little bit at deacon, because that's part of church government. I'd like to also get into, and I don't know if I'll make it tomorrow night, but I'd like to get into things that hinder people from being effective officers. We're talking about their qualifications. What hinders them? What do you do when a man's no longer fulfilling his role as an officer?